Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Well, we move on. Until 2018, only a few people knew that the Cork-based writer Trish Carney was the same person as Patricia McCahill, a gifted swimmer who, as a Dublin teenager, was tipped for Olympic success. That year, she allowed her identity become public in a newspaper article about serial abuse by a prominent swimming coach who was recently the subject of a major Irish-made podcast series. And I'm sure that some of you will have heard Trish's powerful testimony in the Where is George Gibney podcast. Well, now Trish Carney is telling her own story. And despite having her childhood stolen, she's still above water, which just happens to be the title of her recently published memoir. And Trish joins me now on the line from her home in Cork. Good morning, Trish.
Hi, Miriam.
Thanks so much for joining us. Listen, anyone who's followed the scandals in Irish swimming, Trish, or who listened to that brilliant Where is George Gibney podcast, they'll know about how you and others, you were groomed and abused as children. But decades later, how are things in your life? I mean, do you now stand free, Trish, from the shadows of that past?
Yeah, well, I suppose that's probably quite a good way to put it, because, you know, if you do stand free from shadows, the shadows are still there. You're just standing a little bit away from them. And that's exactly the way it is for me in everyday life. You know, I suppose the thing that people would normally, you know, kind of equate with it is that, you know, we carry our scars and, you know, for a time they're a little bit, you know, kind of grotesque on you and within you. And then you learn to live with them. And then hopefully there comes a day where you're actually quite proud of them. And I think that's probably quite true of where I am today. You know, the shadows are there, the scars are there. And so they should be, because, you know, they were a huge part of my life. And they're a huge part in understanding where I am in my life. But they certainly, you know, I do stand in the sunshine, I must admit. And anyone who knows me will, will, I think, agree with that.
Absolutely. And I have your book in front of me. It's a great read. It's very powerful, Trish, actually. One of the subtitles is A Stolen Childhood. I mean, you endured that horrendous abuse. Do you mourn, though, a little for that lost childhood, Trish?
I certainly mourned it immensely for a time. Especially when I was, you know, when my children were younger and I was a mother, and I really firmly began to understand what that child lost. But I have to say, having, you know, written the book, a lot of people, you, when I was writing the book, you know, were kind of so happy for me because they thought this was going to be wonderfully cathartic. But I suppose that used to grate a little bit with me, because it kind of made me think, did they not know I've actually worked very, very, very hard already through my life? But what the book did really bring home to me was there's a few chapters in it where I do write about, you know, various episodes as that young girl. And I kind of, you know, reequated me with a different side of her, not the mammy looking back at the little girl, but, you know, I actually became her and I relived those moments. And I have to say, it was the only time I actually shed a tear in the book, and it was for, you know, kind of joy and happiness, because I just thought, wow, you know, I was not a pathetic, sad child, of which I, of course, was. But ultimately, I was very strong and very brave to actually be doing any of what I was doing at the time. And it was lovely to reequate myself and reintroduce myself to that child as an adult, and just kind of literally take a moment to sit back and go, well, fair play to you. You were braver then, I think, than you were now, you know, and that was lovely.
That's a really touching way of actually looking at it. And then, I mean, you didn't hide yourself away, Trish, but you changed your name. I suppose you moved far away from your native Cork. How does it now feel to be very much in the spotlight? I mean, doing this show, I saw you on The Late Late. I read that brilliant article yesterday in the Indo with Catherine. What does it feel like now to be out there? Do you feel very proud of yourself?
I think it's a little bit too soon. I think I'm in the headlights. You know, I absolutely wrote this book for my children because I kind of began to think when Mum died that there was so much I couldn't remember of the lovely story she told us. And I kind of thought, you know, if I'm hit by a bus in the morning, my children will only know what was printed in the papers. And that's they're kind of the facts. They're not the story behind the facts. And so I kind of, and I had a good bit of it written, and I had even discussed it with my mum before she died. You know, we jokingly said a lot of people had to die first. So that was the reason behind it. Then I kind of thought it would be nice to see it in a book, but it, and that was what I pursued. And then the podcast came out. And the podcast just got such, you know, reinvigorated a whole new generation of people's interest in what is an actual bizarre story, really. And so, you know, I never, ever set out, while I love my book and I, you know, Above Water is such a great title for it as such, you know, but I never set out to write a book for many, many people to read it. So I am a little bit kind of dazed that there is such an interest in my story. But having said that, I think in time, I will be delighted. And what is lovely is, you know, Miriam, I sent out my book to my family and to my very close friends. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done because I don't discuss it. I don't, I sometimes think I'm a little bit like those people from the world wars, you know, that said, oh, yeah, but we never knew he did this in the war. You know, and it's not that we were brave or anything, but we were just living, getting on. And to hand it to my family and my friends and know I'm up, you know, during a pandemic, that I'm making them sad. And now here I am, you know, and it's only a few weeks since they got to see it. And they're, you know, just I'm reflecting their pride, and they're making me feel proud rather than the book, if you get what
yeah,
I mean.
Yeah, I totally understand. Know. Yeah. I mean, interestingly, I love acknowledgements in books, and yours are at the back, and you mention, you know, Chalky White, his bravery in speaking to Gary O'Toole. You talk about Gary shining a light into the door, you know, to dark corner of the past, Johnny Waterson. Was it hard for you over the years to not talk about it? And was it almost a relief when people did start to talk about it?
I suppose, you know, there's two things that I think about that. Initially, it was the hardest thing I've ever done to find the words. You know, it was almost like a selective mutism in terms of I absolutely chose to forget and never speak about it. And to have that forced out of me was extremely difficult in 1994. That was the hard, you know, just impossibly hard to speak to my husband, to speak to the guards was just, you know, that's a nightmare I'll never forget. You know, not that the guards weren't absolutely lovely, but to actually articulate, you know, your past to them when you didn't even speak to yourself about it. And that was incredibly hard. But I have to say, as time has gone on, it got easier and easier. Now, it was never a secret with my friends and family, really, from then on. You know, slowly it just seeped out. But in terms of the public domain, it was a secret. And talking to Mark at the Where's George Gibney podcast, that was another big deal. But it was really, I suppose, the whole thing changed with Johnny Waterson when Johnny, you know, said he was going to do that follow-up article. And just in a moment, he said to me, you know, and I'll, you can be anonymous, Trish. And without forethought, I just said, no, Johnny, you can print my name. And that was a sea change. And it was just a tiny, tiny moment. But it has led to an amazing difference in my outlook. And I am public now, well and truly, I'm afraid.
Absolutely. I mean, was in terms of your husband, I know just even reading the book, like he's been so important in your life. Was it difficult the first time you told Eamon?
Yeah. Eamon is just an absolute rock. Eamon is, you know, he's the jigsaw piece for me that just kind of changed everything. You know, Eamon allows me to be me. So that was the way from the very, very beginning. And so when I got the letter from Gary and I had to face the past, and Eamon really didn't know about it. You know, we were even talking this morning and Eamon said he knew that there was moments where I was, you know, that things had happened that were a bit bizarre. Like, as he said, you know, the bowling alley, just, you know, leaving the bowling alley because Gibney was there over my shoulder. But he didn't know why we were leaving. But, you know, so he said there was a little element of him knowing there was something. So maybe, you know, it wasn't that much of a strange thing when I said, look, read that letter. But I never really went into the past with him. I've never discussed the details. So Eamon just deals with the reality of who I am, where I am. And he has always just allowed me to be me. So if I want to be in a bad mood and cry or whatever, and eventually he'll get to the bottom of it, but he doesn't need me to get to today. he'll just wait. And it always comes out in the end, you know, with him. But I just found that tremendously healing over the years, that Eamon has just allowed me heal and never felt that he had to fix me. He's just so confident in his own, you know, in his own being. He's, you know, I put a huge amount of my healing and my peace of mind down to the fact that I was never pressured to be well. I was just accepted regardless.
It's so lovely you found him and met him. Actually, it was tougher on your, I know your dad died young from motor urine disease, but it was tougher on your mum to deal with, wasn't it, Trish?
Oh, it was extremely difficult. I mean, you know, I think the difference nowadays, and it's very, very difficult to put 2021 back into the 90s. You know, everyone is so aware and so educated and so, you know, as child abuse or even any form of abuse, attack, sexual attack is so out there in the public domain. But it wasn't anywhere in Irish life when I brought it up with my mum. And in fact, you know, it was almost unheard of. And I don't think my mother could, number one, she couldn't understand that the girl that she had seen in her house, that she had minded and loved and cared for, had actually not been that child at all. And she didn't actually have the knowledge to understand what the details were. And I hadn't the language to tell her. I hadn't the heart really to tell her the reality. So she was trying to grasp, you know, what was after going on. And I think she found it very, very difficult. And, you know, being so raw myself, and I was very young, you know, I was only 28, 29 with two small children, and I was living in a country that literally was saying you're telling lies. So I was very, you know, kind of sensitive about it. So unless she had literally thrown her arms around me and said, I completely understand, we were never actually going to be on the same page. And, she, you know, for mum, that was just very, she couldn't do that initially because she didn't understand. Now, she didn't reject me. She didn't argue with me. But we came up with what I think is a wonderful Irish solution. We just, you know, lived a life with that not spoken about until eventually said enough, and I reached out to her, and that was, you know, a good 4 or 5 years later. And the great thing is that having made that choice to sort of accept the fact that she was struggling with all of this and understanding it, and just say, look, I don't mind, I want a relationship with my mum, and if I do have a relationship with my mum, I cannot hold this against her. And I reached out, and, you know, in that, it actually broke the ice between us, and we had the conversations that we didn't have. We didn't really overly go into, you know, my telling her ever, but we did go into many, many conversations. And I up until she died, I had just, oh my goodness, the most tremendous relationship, and I would have lost that. I'm so grateful. And Gibney would have caused that, which would have been just so wrong. You know, that would have been something that I think would have been very hard to deal with.
At the very end of your book, Trish, you say, you know, throughout my life, I have fought many battles. Some I've won, some I've lost. But in my battle against Gibney, there are many who believe I did not get the justice I deserve. But is there not justice in being able to say I have lived a life, believed, happy and loved? What more could I wish for? I find that amazing. You're so forgiving, you're so at peace with yourself. Do you ever feel angry that there he is walking around Florida? How do you deal with that, Trish?
Time has helped me deal with it. If you had interviewed me maybe 15, 20 years ago, I could have sat here spitting. But I suppose now I've grown up. I felt that there were, you know, I am a very positive person. I do try to take, you know, to make it into a positive. And I feel for me, the positive has always been that I, you know, all those flashes that I might have of him, is that him over there around the corner? Did I just smell his aftershave? I was able to heal myself knowing, you know, there's not even a chance that's true. And that was very healing. And then I suppose as time went on, you know, I began to just be happy that I was living a life, as I always say, that he didn't share my sky. I got up in the morning. I live in Ireland. I don't just live in Cork. I don't live away from Gibney. I live miles away from Gibney. And the other thing is then that, you know, to actively hate someone, hating someone is a very active process. You have to fuel it almost daily. You know, you do have to stoke the fires of hate. And it's an incredibly negative emotion. So, you know, I did make a very active choice not to go down that road. But as for forgiveness or forgetting, there's a long list of people that'll never get off the forgiveness or the forgetting. but I don't dwell on it, and I certainly don't stoke those fires. You know, I live with them, and there was an awful lot of people, you know, not only Gibney, but that wronged us, and that could have made differences. Like George Gibney was abusing people for 13 years before I ever came on the scene. You know, if Gary O'Toole hadn't come forward as amazingly as he did, you know, there would be a lot of people over in Scotland that would be still, you know, living a life post abuse, and they didn't. You know, so while they didn't stop it, nobody stopped it in time for me. I really do believe there are people skipping through their morning today, and they have no idea the life they escaped, no idea whatsoever. And I suppose that you know, there's a measure of, for me, a sense of justice for myself personally in all of that. And anyway, Miriam, like, if he did get tried, he would be out. What jail sentence would ever suffice for me personally?
That's just such an interesting way of looking at it. And Trish, it's been lovely talking to you. Delighted you've ended up so happy in your life. Thanks for telling your story. And if listeners, and they should read your book, because it's a really powerful book and it's not depressing. It's called, very appropriately, Above Water. It's published by Hachette, and it can be bought online from all good bookshops. Mind yourself, Trish. Thanks so much for talking to me this morning.
Thanks so much. Thanks a million.
Yeah, bye. Mind yourself.